Welcome back, everyone. I'm Al Sue, and today we have a program about restorative justice. Our panel includes Barbara General, Tom Porter, Lady Cano, Lee Hill, Lance Logan Key, and Abby Every. And we're talking and getting an education in some of our cases about restorative justice. And we're going to turn the floor back over to Barb.
Hi. So the next question I have is towards our RJ program, and for Lee and Lady to answer in regards to what is the underlying philosophy and the values guiding the work of the restorative justice program and your practice? And if you could identify the difference between what is restorative justice and what is restorative practice, that would be good too.
Thanks, Barb, for that great question. I'll go first, being okay. The newbie on the team. As far as I know, some of the values that we have... Oh, sorry, I get close to the microphone, everybody. I'm sorry about that. Okay, is that better? Okay. I keep swallowing. Some of the values that we have, I believe, are... we call them the Hohenzollern legal principles. And that would encompass, from what I can remember... And forgive me because I can't pronounce them yet in the language, but I'm learning, and I'm lucky to have the opportunity to learn some of the language. But as love and compassion, respectfulness, truthfulness, trustworthiness, understanding, and working together. And I think it just basically encompasses a lot of our, again, like Hohenzollern teachings that were spoken to last night in regarding how to... And I think it's really important because we have to be the example, right? So it's important that we are able to use those values so that we can do the work, first of all, with ourselves, to be that way with ourselves. And then that way, when we're that way with ourselves, we're able to do that with others. So that's a really big piece in a lot of work that's important for one of us to do. And even Tom was speaking about that last night. He was speaking how we have to be that example, especially for our young people. Like the way that we interact with one another, the way that we approach day-to-day activities really can speak to who we are as a person. And being Indigenous, it's more about not just following those principles, but inherently having a lot of that love and compassion, understanding, and using that good mind, having that kind of quio to be able to make a decision that is based on who we are, who we want to be. Because we are, again, healing. We're in a healing process. But I think that that's about bringing people together to be able to give them the opportunity to see who they really are and remind them of who they really are. Because everybody inside has the ability to be that person, but through what we've been through and the stories that we've carried, you're not your story. You know, we're not our story. You're not your behaviors. Things have brought you to that, and just reminding people with those principles that's who we are, who we really are. And I forgot the other half of the question because I'm so nervous.
Lady, maybe you can answer this question. What's the difference between restorative justice and restorative practice?
So to put it away, then I understand. So restorative justice and restorative practices are both very connected because they are under the same principles. However, when it comes to restorative justice, we are looking at the more reactive part of it. So meaning that we are doing this with people that are already involved with the system with regards to criminal matters. So when we're talking about practice, we are talking about more preventive part of it. It's looking at building community, building capacity. So it's looking at the social, it's kind of like studying, we look at it as a social science, like studying different alternatives for the community to bring forward issues without the need of the involvement of the criminal justice system or without the need of punishment. So the best example that I can give for restorative practices will be the school system. So I think that's part of that we need to change because the school system takes on part of the punitive aspects and is also used at the criminal justice system. So we see, sometimes I see schools as a jail. So we see how the structure and how kids have time for everything, how they had to ask permission for something, how they are being punished. So we don't have programs in the schools. to give kids the opportunity to learn about how to manage their behaviors in a healthy way without being isolated, without being labeled as a bad kid. So I think that's part of the practice that we need to get there going, having programs to teach people, to teach their students about how to control the emotions, how to be self-regulated. But to me, it has to start with also the teachers. We have teachers that are not self-regulated, teachers that get frustrated and don't know how to handle these situations, so they are going to be creating more harm. So that's when we start doing the prevention part of it. And also, those are kids that are going to be healthy kids, and those are kids that are not going to be involved with the justice system.
I think those are good points that you make in regards to the practice. I think when we look at systemically why, especially at Six Nations now, the issue of the bullying that's happening here. But, you know, a couple of times I've heard teachers say to me, and they've said to me, well, we're not social workers, right? And we haven't learned that. So I think it's a systemic issue when it comes to and we also see that the kids that bully are the ones that sometimes, not all of them, but end up in the criminal justice system, right? But we're looking at how they treat our kids, and our kids go, they absorb the unspoken hierarchy, you know, that occurs in the school. You're talking about that piece. I think they absorb that, the teachers reinforce it, mm-hmm. right? And so then they learn how to be small and not to be big. Like, we're all supposed to be people that love each other and promote each other, yeah. encourage each other, but we don't see that piece where they're taught to be small.
Yeah.
And then when they can't really be themselves, it comes out sideways. And the issues at home come out sideways in school, too. So it's about family, it's about school, it's about the whole community yeah. being on board, like Tom said, in regards to having that love for one another, right? And that's where it is. It's about love at the end yeah. of the day, caring about yeah. each other. And that's what we want to promote in our department, is that love, right?
Yeah. So but adding to that, I think you hit a good point. It's about separating the person from the behavior. So I think that's very important, because people cannot become those labels. And that's what we're doing now with kids and with everybody, because we are really quick to judge and we are not being compassionate. And I think we have to understand where people are coming from and the trauma they are dealing with.
Mm-hmm. I think what has to be changed is in the curriculum for teachers is to teach them about RJ, how to work with kids, you know, how to get them to sit down and talk about why they're angry or why they hurt somebody. Mm-hmm. And that's not happening. It's a punitive system. I don't want to say all teachers, because, and I don't say all yeah. of anybody, but there mm-hmm. it's a system, right? And yeah. we have some really good teachers that can step outside that box and do some good work, but it's not resonating throughout the whole school system. Do you have anything to add to that, Tom? No. I said no. No. Okay. The next question I have is, what is the overarching social narrative of Indigenous people that incites the need for the RJ process and practice that you do? So you're talking about a systemic, so talk more about that piece.
So I can only speak to what I have been doing and I hear doing this work. But I think part of the social narrative, the biggest issue that we have is the over-representation of Indigenous people in jail. I think that's the biggest part of it, and that's why we have this program. So we haven't seen any changes regardless of how many programs are being implemented in different communities. So I was looking at some statistics, and I noticed that in still reducing the levels of incarceration, they are increasing. So we look at 2005 to now. By then, when we look at people in prison at the provincial level, I was about 21%, and now it is 28%, and it's very similar to for the youth. So in 2005 and 2006, it was 90%, and now it's about 29% too. And there are many provinces in which the levels of incarceration of Indigenous peoples are really high. Like, I think in Saskatchewan, it's about 74%. And we know that many Indigenous communities don't have other options for their people, so they don't have community programs, they don't have anything that offenders can access to meet their needs, so they're put in jail just simply because the system has failed and there are no programs for them.
Judy.
Thanks, lady.
Just a disclaimer, I'm not an expert in any means. Anything that comes out of my mouth is strictly an opinion, so please, anybody who's listening, don't think that I am. I'm not trying to say I know all things. But I think what I think you're asking, and I just want to clarify that, you're asking what some of the overarching social issues are that are causing the need for restorative justice. Mm-hmm. Where do we begin is the really big question, because I feel like the basic way for me to express my opinion is talking about a basic model as a Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? There's a basic need that people, mm-hmm. human beings deserve before they can move up the ladder to self-actualization, to becoming your best self. And the basic needs are water, shelter, and food. And when you take a look at a lot of Native communities around Ontario and even Canada, what is the access? You have to ask yourself, what is the access to food? To fresh food? How many people are farming? Can they farm? When you go up into Northern Ontario, there's no, mm-hmm. the access to fresh food is near to impossible. I worked there 2 years, and it was really, it opened my eyes to the differences in Indigenous communities and what's lacking. And then the access to fresh water, you know, who has running water, who doesn't have running water, who has drinkable water, who doesn't have drinking water. And it even talks about whether or not if we as a people, if the majority of us aren't given the basic needs, it affects us as a people, not just individually or just as that family, but it affects us, all of us, if some of us aren't able to move up that ladder. It's holding all of us back as a people. So we have to do our best to take, again, it goes back to taking care of one another and like helping one another out when we need that help. Like a lot of things that Tom talked about last night is I really like that piece when you talked about your nephew. That even if my nephew is using drugs and I see him using drugs, I still go and I visit him and I love him and I talk to him and I tell him, you know, I love you and I'm here for you. I don't know why you use the drugs, but I just know that I'm here for you. And the nephew would tell you that I love you. Like, thank you, Uncle, for talking to me. I feel good when you talk to me because you're not judging it. It's extending that, because for some reason we have it in our mind that if somebody's not on a good path that we need to stay away. Or you know, give them that, you called it tough love. And so I think, again, like when we're doing this healing, we have to take a look at like, what are our needs as a people? Are our needs being met? And like, if we're not being met and we can't rely on the government to meet them, because obviously after this long, mm-hmm. if they're still not meeting those needs, then we have to take a good look at what our big systems are. How can we develop that as a people? And we need to be responsible and help one another. And that comes with taking care of yourself first. Again, it always comes down to taking care of yourself and meeting your own personal needs. So I think that's my personal opinion on the situation, is I think that there's needs being met on a basic level that aren't being met. And then when you look at the systems, there's the school systems. Because in order to take a look at those macro systems, you have to really understand where it all starts from. Because when you take care of yourself and you put yourself in a well position, you are able to take care of others.
Abby?
In my experience as well, just in the criminal courts, a lot of the reoffending is because of addictions. And the addictions because of trauma and because of pain. So those are the issues that need to be addressed. And the criminal court is not equipped to deal with trauma and the pain of it. But in my experience, it's a lot of addiction issues that are the driving force behind the criminal offenses that are committed.
And I think I should have clarified when I meant by social narrative. We're looking at the police, the social narrative and how they treat our people. We're looking at the courts and how they treat Indigenous people when it comes to crime. So they're not looking at the manifestation of the behavior. You know, they're looking at the behavior. And this is what is the difference for restorative justice, if we get down to the root of the problem. What is the cause of this? The manifestation is they've had a lifelong of trauma with their families. They had, you know, they were introduced to drugs when they were in their families. They were taught how to steal when they were young, right? And so this just becomes a norm for them to do. But the overarching social narrative is the oppressive policies that have come down on Indigenous people that still are existing in regards to the Indian Act and, you know, status cards. Those are oppressive still. Yeah. We're the only ones who have to have, you know, determine or tell people how much blood we have in regards to being a Native or Indigenous, right? So those are oppressive things. We are not in the in a position where we are truly self determined or full sovereignty here. And those are things that are oppressive when we talk about the social narrative and how that impacts unconsciously and consciously our people when we're operating daily and functioning. Those things actually help in that manifestations of those behaviors. Mm-hmm. You look like you have something to say there, Lance.
I'm just listening really intently. I do. Yeah. Coming from the youth side of it, mm-hmm. typically, once I've been working with youth for a while, I start losing sight of what their actual offense was. Because mm-hmm. You asked me here to talk about the EGM program, but a lot of the stuff you're talking about, I actually find more in the other program I run, mm-hmm. which is the reintegration program. Mm-hmm. So that's youth who's come through the system and got a probation order. If they make it to my caseload, they're the ones who need a lot of extra support. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in danger of losing their education, becoming homeless, addictions, yeah. All those things. And that's the approach that we take, not just me particularly as in my job, but generally in the office, both in the adult side and the youth side, is trying to address the reasons why the behavior is there. Especially in the youth, they're basically just doing what they've learned with the options that they know are available to them. So that's our approach. And it's restorative, still keeping in mind that we have to stay within the rules of the legal system, probation orders, all of those things. But we take it, we go beyond that. So we try to address all of those things. Because recidivism is really what our goal is, to make sure that that's not happening. Mm-hmm. Giving them better options, giving them better directions. We train them how to think, how to understand their situation, and how to, if they can't see positive options, how do they find positive options? Because they're there. They've been trained not to see them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Anybody else on that question? No. I think one of the things I see, through the whole department and our other programs is that the victims who have been hurt, traumatized, and I'm seeing this, have no compassion for the accused or the offender or the one that has done the bad act. None whatsoever. But at the same time, I think I want them to learn that at any time, they could become an offender. At any moment in our lives, it doesn't matter. We never know what's going to happen to us that would push us in that direction. And we're not perfect people. We're human beings. We make mistakes. But to get them to understand, to try and put themselves in the shoes of the offender. Because I think if you can't do that, if you're not able to do that, where's the love going to come from in order to help the people? We got to help the victim. We also have to help the offender. In order to move forward in our healing as a community and communities across, Turtle Island, we have to be able to help both. And I feel that right now it's just the victim that we're helping. We put a lot of energy in, but we also have to look at the offender because we're not moving, symmetrically. It's just, the victims has helped a lot more where the offender is not. And we have to start to have more compassion to understand what is the root problem here in regards to helping that person and how do we help them. And it can't just be a program. It has to be the whole community that helps them and say, yeah, we support this initiative, right? Because it's so much pressure on the program sometimes. And the community then comes down on us, oh, you did this and this and this, or you didn't do this and this. And it's like, well, where were you? Where are you, So you're equally responsible. We're a program. But I think the community is equally responsible in helping us heal all together, right? So I just want to put that out there because I feel that we see that and we're looking at ways where we can actually educate the community more and get them on board with the programs under the department.
But isn't that where healing comes in? Mm-hmm. When people are healing,
yeah.
they're more apt to consider the other perspective. Mm-hmm. In the criminal court system, it draws hard lines. As soon as somebody is charged, there's no communication. Mm-hmm. As they're on a form of release, a recognizance, it has no contact with the victim at all, mm-hmm. not attend with the victim.
But it's that system that is dividing us. I think it's the Canadian system that we have been conditioned to believe in, yeah. right, and that divides us. And I think that they say, okay, you're guilty, or you committed this act, you're guilty, I want nothing to do with you anymore because you did this. But nobody's there for the offender or the accused, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's your system. It's not your system, Abby, but the system.
Thank you.
I get really
feeling lonely here.
That has
Tom was talking about that the other day. He was talking about how when he worked in the prisons, and he would forget because he said he got treated. You told us, please correct me if I'm wrong, that you were treated better by the inmates, and they gave you more respect than the guards did. And you spoke a lot about that. Would you mind speaking more about that? Because, I mean, you told us, but the rest of the community didn't get to hear your story when it comes to, like, how that even that environment can be not supportive to Indigenous people or to people, period.
Yeah, well, I was simply stating that I think that the system that we have to operate in doesn't have a human sensitivity to it. It almost like it's heartless. It deals with just cold facts. It doesn't really take into consideration how it emotionally affects you or anybody. And yet, all humans, that's the basis of our life. We're all looking for that since we're born. And the systems that we're talking about that gives us problem, or it doesn't have that. And how do you make that have that? So I worked for the New York State Department of Corrections for, I believe it was 11 years or 12 years, as a Native American chaplain for 72 jails. And I was telling them that I felt much safer with the inmates. They really respected me and they really helped me. And they would grab stuff that I'm carrying for ceremonies and it helped me. Now, in the 11 years I was there, only one guard picked up the basket to carry it for me once. And when that one guard did that, I was so happy, because I says, how come this is the Department of Corrections, the name of New York State Department of Corrections, and why do the guards not try to correct? Why do the guards, and the women included, that's guards, use the F word so much? And they don't care if a imam listens, or a rabbi listens, or a Native American child listens. They let us hear it. They'll say it. That's not being corrective at all. And then the inmates, I never hear them say that when I'm around. They're very careful. I don't know if they say it when I'm not there, but guards don't care or not. Okay. Picked up the basket. It was a heavy basket because I cook for them. Teach them how to cook cornbread and all that stuff in the prison. And so it's heavy. I'm carrying stuff. That one guard, for the first time in 11 years, picked up that, and I pretty much cried. That's the first time one ever showed any to help. So after that, we finished the day. I went to the superintendent, the one that runs the prison in Auburn, and I said, that one guard helped me today. First time in 11 years, any guard in the whole state system has ever helped me to carry stuff. I want to know if it's all right. Can I invite that guard and take him to supper, and I'll pay for him? Because I was so thrilled that he was the first one that gives me faith in a system that's for correction. First time I've seen it in 11 years. Oh, no, no. That's against the rules. You can't do any kindness because it's going to be taken as, according to the rules, then you can corner me, I guess, or I can corner him to do favors. And they don't allow that. But that's just a human to say thank you. It's not allowed. So there's something to say about the whole system. How do you bring back the human touch, the human the most sacred thing is love and compassion. How do you do that? Mm-hmm. And it's against the law. It's very troubling.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, ladies and gentlemen, this is a program on restorative justice here at CKRZ. And with us today, we have Barbara General, Tom Porter, Lady Canal, Lee Hill, Lance Logan Key, and Abby Avery. I'm your host for this program today, Al Sue, and we'll be back in 30 seconds.
Here's a fun fact about restorative justice. Did you know that the guiding philosophy of restorative justice is based on Haudenosaunee legal practices and values? The integration of love, encouragement, inner peace, cooperation, honesty, respect, responsibility, consistency, and integrity are the backbone of our process.